Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren and we are recording from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in. It's good to have you here. You're up for an interesting program today. As you know, the website is redicecreations.com. News, forum, radio archive, member section, film, newsletter and much more. So do take a look, and if you like what we do here, help spread the word and tell your friends. All right, in my hand I hold a copy of a very interesting book. It's called Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. This is a fascinating book tracing the origins of the comic book heroes all the way back to the ancient world, the ancient mythologies, and tracks it through history, how it has developed. It also discusses how many actually secret societies have been instrumental in making the comic book genre a reality. The book is a little bit like an encyclopedia almost of some of the most important people, not only within the comic book industry, writers and illustrators, but also people that have been influential within the occult, that have kind of helped to spawn this genre of comic books. We're going to talk about this and much more today with the author, Christopher Knowles. We have with us on the line. By the way, I want to mention that the book is illustrated by Joseph Michael Linzer. Beautiful illustrations that go with the symbolism all the way, you know, superheroes with the square and the compass and the Kabbalah on their chests is beautifully illustrated. Chris Knowles is with us, and I also want to mention his blog that you can check out here during our talk, secretsun.blogspot.com, and that will get you right to his blog so you can check out more on that. All right, welcome to the program, Christopher Knowles. Wonderful to have you here.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Henrik. I'm a big fan of your show and a big fan of your work.
Excellent, thank you. You know, to set the tone for our program here today, to get an idea what we're talking about, I want to read two paragraphs from your book, Our Gods Wear Spandex. Although most of us don't realize it, there's simply nothing new about devotion to superheroes. Their powers, their costumes, and sometimes even their names are plucked straight from the pre-Christian religion of antiquity. When you go back and look at these heroes in the original incarnations, you can't help but be struck by how blatant their symbolism is and how strongly they reflect the belief system of the pagan age. What even fewer people realize is that this didn't occur by chance, but came directly out of the spiritual and mystical secret societies and cults of the late 19th century. Groups like the Theosophists, the Rosicrucians, and the Golden Dawn. These groups turned their backs on the state cult of Christianity and reached back in time to the elemental deities of the ancient traditions, inspired by the same cultural and spiritual ferment that afflicts us in our post-9/11 world. Artists and architects of this neoclassical movement portrayed the gods and beliefs of the ancient world in works that survive today in the major cities of the West. In Manhattan alone, we find Mercury, messenger of the gods, at Grand Central Station. We see Isis, queen of heaven and star of the sea, at the Statue of Liberty, and a whole host of images and symbols of ancient gods at Rockefeller Center. The young artist who created the great superheroes grew up immersed in this atmosphere. All over the finest neighborhoods in Manhattan, you find gods lurking everywhere, in lobbies or doorways, in elevators and on rooftops. These young artists, city kids really, looted the treasures of the ancient world from art schools and museums to create our new gods. Yeah, there's a passage there from the new book by Christopher Knowles, Our Gods Wear Spandex. And Christopher, I gotta say, going through your book, you quickly discover that you have a, you know, very comprehensive and detailed knowledge of how the comic book industry came to be, how it has developed, and what some of the most influential people working within it has been. And I'd love to know a little bit about your background in comics, if you will.
Well, first of all, I just want to say what an amazing synchronicity is that you chose that passage to open our talk with, because that's something that I'm in the midst of exploring even deeper now. How New York City really was such a powerful influence on the development of these TROs. I actually worked in New York as an artist. I worked in the Empire State Building for several years, which is actually a giant obelisk on 33rd Street, so the symbolism there is kind of unmistakable. I don't know if any of your listeners have been to the Empire State Building, but the minute you walk in the lobby, you see a giant relief on the wall of the Empire State Building as an obelisk, with the rays of the sun coming from the tip of the building. I mean, the symbolism there is so clear, it's so unmistakable.
Yeah.
And by walking around the city, I sort of had the experience that the kids who invented comics in the first place had. These were kids who lived in ethnic enclaves or ghettos in the early part of the 20th century and were amazed by the wealth and power that they saw, particularly in Midtown Manhattan, stretching from the Empire State Building over to the Chrysler Building, the Grand Central Station. I mean, these neighborhoods, which I've walked through personally for many, many years, when I was working in New York and then when I was working as a freelancer, drawing superheroes, drawing cartoons, all these kinds of things. I relived this experience. It was an amazing thing for me to have drawn upon, and I could bring that to the book. But when I was walking around these neighborhoods, everywhere you went, you could not, you couldn't avoid being confronted with these symbols everywhere. This all came out of the neoclassical movement, as you said in the excerpt of the book. And I really believe that the engine behind the neoclassical movement was groups like the Golden Dawn, like the Theosophical Society, the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, that really looked for an answer to the existential crisis of the Industrial Age by the discovery of ancient texts, the Hermetic texts. You had the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, and all of a sudden all the Egyptian texts were being transcribed for the first time ever. You had the discovery of King Tut's tomb, which I think was very, very powerful influence on the origin of comics, because so many characters, to name Hawkman and Dr. Fate, very popular characters of the Golden Age of comics, very clearly drew upon the King Tut's tomb mythos. So what you had was this conjunction of events in history where you had massive immigration to the New World, you had the Great Depression and the oncoming of World War II, and then you had the remnants of this amazing pagan revival that took place in the late 19th century. So this is something I've been thinking very very much about, how the city itself was a huge influence, because the city, Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan, is almost like a pagan temple. If you are familiar with the symbolism, if you are familiar with the language, because symbolism is a language, if you are familiar with that, you can't help but see this everywhere you go in Manhattan. Rockefeller Center is it's an amazing example of this. You have that statue of Prometheus, which I believe is Mithras, because you have him rising from the rock, holding the flame, and surrounded by the Zodiac. I mean, there's no mention of the Zodiac in the stories of Prometheus. I mean, that's Mithras. So, not to be long-winded about this, but it's very exciting to me that you brought that up.
Excellent.
Synchronicity.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. And I want to just interject here. I mean, New York, after all, New York City in New York is called the Big Apples. I mean, to some extent, we couldn't get more, I guess, in tune to the, maybe not the pagan world, but at least that there is a hint that there is some kind of hidden knowledge there. Again, going back to the story of, the Adam and Eve in the garden, basically.
Yeah, and the golden apples of the sun, things like that. I mean, there's a lot of symbolism, the fruit of the tree of knowledge, Gnosis. I mean, there's a lot of symbols that tie into that. But if you can just perhaps go on the web and sort of poke around, look at Grand Central Station, the main lobby, you have the constellations on the sky. I mean, you have the giant relief of Mercury and his attendants on the the side facing Madison Avenue. It's just amazing. When you know the language, it speaks to you. And the way I look at it is that I don't see this as some sort of literal paganism where you're animist nature worship. It's, to me, it's a revival of the high pagan ideal, or the high pre-Christian, or the high Gnostic ideal, the high Neoplatonic ideal of the language of symbols.
Interesting. We definitely want to talk more about that later on and get into that and see what some of these characters behind this also could be, of course, and how this is connected, you know, with the many secret societies and also, you know, Freemasonry and so forth. But before we go there, I just want to mention, you know, the cover of your book is amazing. I mean, it's very nice. The Last Supper. Tell us about it and how you guys came up with this particular image.
Well, I've got to give full credit to Joseph Michael Lenzner, a good friend of mine, an amazing artist. That was his concept. That was his idea, and he executed it beautifully. I wanted something that would show how comic book superheroes have become the new mythology. Now, Joseph Campbell once said that modern culture had no real mythology, and I always, having learned to read at the age of 3 by reading comics, I always thought this was sort of absurd, because I always saw superheroes as being our mythology. I mean, the greatest example of this is during World War II, when superheroes were very much part of the war effort. They were mascots.
Yeah.
And there's no clearer example of mythology than that, than a GI walking around with a bunch of Superman comics in his duffel bag. So Joe took that ball and ran with it and came up with that beautiful image, beautiful, iconic image, I think.
Yeah.
He was also referring, you know, to the whole Da Vinci Code mythos, and the, you know, the things we know about Leonardo and his involvement with secret societies and his involvement with just hidden knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. And again, it references that idea that you discuss throughout the book, that it's a bit of a, you know, a retelling in some instances of the Christ story, but also kind of a I guess a replacement of it, and we're certainly going to get into that. What I want to ask you...
I wouldn't say necessarily replacement. I think that's a bit loaded, but it's a replaying, a reimagining.
A retelling of the story?
Yeah, I think so. I think that a lot of those same impulses... If you look at the 1930s and you look at what was going on in the culture then, it in a lot of ways it's similar to, you know, first century Palestine, you know? You had a lot of chaos and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fear about the future in both eras, and that's when these messiah archetypes will emerge. You know, this need for a savior figure, and I think that that's something that ties both time periods together really well.
Interesting. What we have to talk about here is how you came to kind of discover this undercurrent or other stream of information that kind of led you into studying the ancient mysteries or mythologies and even the occult. When did your eyes kind of first open to this, or have you always been steeped in this, considering your background in comics?
Well, exactly. I mean, reading comics from a very early age, you can't avoid this material. One of the comics, my uncles had a lot of comics, and I'd go to my grandma's house and I'd read their comics. And I remember seeing one comic, an advertisement for a comic that I wouldn't see till much later, and it was called The New Gods. And it was this series that just inculcated itself into my imagination. But that was really drawn upon the Norse pantheon of Mighty Thor is a very popular comic character in America. And that was one of my favorites. I mean, I remember actually sitting in church, sort of tuning out the sermon and just picturing myself as the Mighty Thor with my hammer, you know, trundling across the tundra with the wind whipping through my hair and the snow and the ice giants, and I just loved that. It was just really captivating to me. I was really immersed in that whole mythology. And it was really beautifully done in the 60s by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, two of my personal heroes, my two personal gods. There was also another character named Dr. Strange, who was an occult magician. And this character was so compelling to me. One of, again, one one of my favorite characters, and was very much of a loner character, very isolated, but, you know, mm-hmm. had these incredible powers and had these, you know, powers to traverse dimensions. And later on, he, in later stories in the 70s, he would deal with the Rosicrucians and the occult founding of America and things like that. So mm-hmm. writers and artists were very much, you know, looking back as I do in this book and finding the same links and the same roots.
Yeah, interesting. So are you saying here that picking up books, you know, like, for instance, Talisman by Graham Hancock, Beauvall, and even looking at stuff that Tracy Twyman writes about and Kenneth Grant, this isn't, has this been with you all the time? Or, I mean, this kind of information or those kind of authors that I mentioned there, have those people been around, you know, for a long time in your life? How did you discover them, so to speak?
I discovered that stuff more or less. I really became really immersed in Carl Jung and Jungian psychology in the, maybe about 15, 20 years ago. And that leads you in all sorts of interesting directions. It's kind of a gateway. And it's almost like, you know, pre-internet linking, that you'll read, somebody will mention something in one book and you'll go to another book. And also getting on the internet at a very early point in the game, there were a lot of people who were interested in these sort of topics who were very much at the forefront of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Again, sort of this hidden knowledge. And it was when I was studying mysticism and studying Jungian psychology, there would be people who would spam these news groups on the internet that I would be reading with all this sort of conspiracy theory material, and I had no idea what this was about.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of started following those connections as well. But I will say, you know, very interesting. I mean, I grew up in a Masonic family. I've never had any, you know, membership in the Freemasons, but I went to a school that was a specialty school for comic book artists, and I received a scholarship from the Eastern Star. So my first real inside knowledge of the Freemasons was going to this giant Freemasonic convention in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I was just stunned by it. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. It was amazing, and it was so ritualistic, and there would be these processions and then this music and these, you know, these incantations, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
It was an amazing experience for me. I was completely oblivious to the meaning of it all until much later.
Hmm.
But
were you foreshadowing
of what I would do later on. Yeah.
Yeah. Were you young at this point, or?
I was 18. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hmm. So you have that kind of background and seeing these images. So when you started, do you think that, let's turn it around, let's say, do you think that those kind of experiences have led you to, you know, pursuing the work, to work with comics and write about it and write for it and illustrate and all of that?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm interested in these subjects, you know, as research. I'm not a practicing member of any society or group or church or cult or anything. I'm really very much on my own.
Sure.
But, you know, the comics programmed me almost from a very early age to really have my eyes open to this material, because a lot of the people writing comics, again, were very much interested in the stuff, and that's something I cover in the book. And there's a, I'll tell you something very interesting. When I was doing research for this book, I interviewed a woman named Catherine Ironwood, who was very well known in comic circles, comics fandom circles, and also very much involved in neo-paganism. And she said something very, very clear. She said that neo-paganism would not have gotten its start without comics and science fiction fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Modern neo-paganism really grows out of comics and sci-fi fandom. And the clearest example of this is that the OTO, the leader of the OTO, was a guy named Grady McMurtry,
mm-hmm.
who was very much involved in science fiction fandom. And, you know, when I studied this book, I discovered that Jack Parsons was very much involved in this stuff.
Yeah.
Jack Parsons would speak before the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society and had a lot of contacts with science fiction writers, and that's where he met L. Ron Hubbard, which is another thing I cover in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating story, definitely. And there's lots to say about that, and maybe we can talk more about that later when we talk a little bit about Crowley and the connections between those guys. That's very interesting. What I want to ask you, I guess, is considering what we talked a little bit about, you know, with your background and so forth, and how you said that the comic books kind of spawned this you know introduction of you know what you call neo paganism almost. But it feels to me that many people that are reading comics actually don't take the step that you have done, meaning that they go into studying the occult or actually become very smart or astute in picking up, you know, symbolism in the architecture and so forth. Maybe that's just, you know, maybe I got the wrong idea. Maybe many of the people, you know, that are into comics are very astute within this field and know, you know, everything what they're looking about. But it doesn't feel like it. What's your idea of this? What's your sense of this?
Well, sometimes I feel like I'm a special case because, like I said, I came from this family on both sides that were very much involved in Freemasonry. We were also a very religious family. The church was very much a focus point for my family. And my mother, who was a professional musician, also played the organ with the choir director at a Jewish temple. And on Saturdays, I would go to Catholic Mass with my friends because I lived in a predominantly Catholic neighborhood. So I sort of grew up steeped in these religious traditions. I mean, pretty much my entire weekend would be religious ceremonies. So I had a very interesting outlook on that. Mm. Also, I just was really enamored of mythology when I was very young. I loved reading the ancient fables and the ancient myths. Edith Hamilton, which we studied in school. And actually, this is a funny story. You know, I told you my fascination with Thor and the Norse mythology and stuff. When I was in sixth grade, I was involved in a production that was entitled Death of the Sun God. It was the school play. It was a sixth grade school play, and it was basically the story of Loki and Balder. And I played Mistletoe. Okay. I don't know if you're familiar with that myth at all, but Loki wants to kill Balder, and Frigga goes around to all the plants and animals of the world and has them promise that they won't harm Balder. Mm. But the only one she overlooks is Mistletoe. So
oops.
I got to play Mistletoe.
That's nice.
So I had almost like an immersive experience with this.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. But again, that was another experience that really made me delve deeper into this mythology.
Definitely.
And, you know, I had a pretty troubled upbringing, had a pretty difficult and troubled childhood. So I was always looking for escapist, you know, fantasy, escape entertainment. So comics and mythology were very much, you know, a refuge for me from, a very troubled childhood.
Yeah. Interesting, you know, that many people seem to you know, cling to against superheroes, and again this kind of leads us into this idea that I want to talk a little bit about now, and this is of course the connection with the more ancient gods or the you know mythologies of the ancient world basically. Again, these are stories that have been around for a long time. We could talk about, you know, Gilgamesh, Horus.
Mm-hmm,
we can talk
exactly,
about
yeah.
Greek Roman myths, or what you just mentioned, the North saga here. There's so many here, and it seems to be that these are kind of archetypal stories that are retold in different versions all the time and renewed all the time. I mean, one thing that you bring up in the book is Gilgamesh, of course, the Sumerian story. Would you say that this is one of the first kind of superhero stories that actually
exactly.
is around?
Hmm? Exactly. I mean, if you look, it's the funniest thing is if you look at the earliest literature that we have in our Western canon, you know, it's predominantly superhero-oriented. I mean, not only Gilgamesh, but Beowulf, and Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the 12 Labors of Hercules, the Contentions of Horace and Seth. So much of the earliest literature in the Western canon is superhero material.
Mm.
And it almost stems from this childlike, magical view of reality that I think was very prevalent in the ancient world before science and technology had taken over.
So this is a way, I guess, to retell all the stories, because again, if we go through many of the mythologies and many of the characters in the mythologies, we can see that it's a constant retelling of this story. It's a constant idea that is coming back again, kind of archetype that I mentioned. Do you think that all these comic books then that we have before us now, and what have consequently happened, of course, is that this has moved into, you know, film and taken a whole new life there, basically. But these stories again are coming to us again from the ancient world and are retelling. Do you think there is a need, you know, within, you know, human and especially young people, maybe teenagers, to have these kind of stories around them? And is that the fact why they are so, you know, mesmerized almost by them?
I think it's a need in everyone. You know, I mean, not only children and teenagers, but adults go see these movies. And, you know, we have an experience where adults, you know, are clinging to this material later and later on in life. I mean, you have people who grew up with this stuff being very powerful in their experience and very powerful in their lives,
mm-hmm.
and they don't let go of it because it's very meaningful to them. And consequently, the subject matter in the comics has matured and grown up with the audience, at least in mainstream American comics. I mean, they really are written for an older audience. And the I'll give you an example. When I was in high school, I worked in a comic book store, and the clientele was largely teenage kids. And if we saw somebody older come in, we was like, "What is he doing in here?"
Yeah.
But today, the average age of comics fan is probably in the mid to late 20s.
Mm.
So the material has matured and has stayed compelling to people, but the same energy that we see in these comics is the same energy that's making these films so powerful. And we've got to talk about 9/11 here, because 9/11 is such a traumatic experience for so many people that you naturally look towards these kind of characters again. And I think if you look at the first Spider-Man movie, which came out the following spring, you know, you have the spectacle with the Green Goblin is, you know, running around destroying all these landmarks in Manhattan.
Mm.
I think that really resonates with people. And you saw the same thing in the Batman Begins movie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we'll leave out the politics and the sort of the diverging views on that whole experience. I mean, that's really almost irrelevant to this conversation. What the effect was is that people felt that they were threatened, vulnerable.
Mm.
And the same thing is happening, you know, that the world is so incredibly chaotic and turbulent right now. So people will, you know, very much be gravitated towards these strong characters. And the danger of that is that we don't want a situation that we saw in the 30s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There was that same need for a strong man, and then we saw the rise of basically totalitarianism as a result of that.
Yeah.
So there is a danger in this. There's a danger inherent in these kinds of impulses. But I would say this, the healthiest way that we can express these impulses, the healthiest way that we can explore issues of like occultism or alchemy or gods or paganism, I think is in fantasy, you know, fantasy entertainment. That's, to me, that's the best place for this place, for this material to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's the healthiest place because we can act these things out, you know, without them sort of bleeding over into uncomfortable real life, you know, cults and strong men cults and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I really think that the best way to immerse yourself in this material is in that context.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. And you're also saying that there's a kind of a cycle here again, almost. I mean, again, we can tie this back to the fact that many of the stories that we have coming out of the ancient world, there are many writers that have written about this, that many of the gods actually were around in a time when you know, we had a pretty different civilization. Some people call it Atlantis or whatever, but things happened apparently in that on that continent or on that world or civilization or empire, where whatever it might have been.
I would love to have written about that stuff. I would have loved to have put stuff about Atlantis. I read a lot of Zechariah Sitchin, and I'm really fascinated by this whole concept. What I really wanted to do with this book is I wanted to just deal with established fact, because there were so many issues that I was raising, connecting so many dots that people might not have had experience connecting before, that I wanted to make sure that I was just really solidly grounded in established fact, established historical fact. But, things like Atlantis, I'm a huge fan of the work of Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by this stuff. I'd love to sort of delve into the stuff, but it almost seems like they've got the market cornered. They do it so well.
I see what you mean.
I don't know what I could add to it, but yeah. I'm really fascinated by that stuff. One of the things I'm really fascinated about is the Normans. I'm really fascinated about how this society, this tribal society, sort of just popped out of nowhere and conquered England and France and Sicily and Syria all within 100 years, you know? I mean, who are these guys? Where did they come from? And I'm really fascinated by the fact that if you look at the kingdoms, the Norman kingdoms, they all spawned these really powerful secret societies. I mean, England spawned the Freemasons, and France spawned the Knights Templar, particularly the Norman part of France.
Mm-hmm.
Syria spawned the Assassins, and Sicily spawned the Mafia. That, to me, is really fascinating. These people who just completely just pop out of nowhere and create these kingdoms and then leave this legacy that is with us today.
That's right. That's right. That's very interesting. Definitely worth.
Now, what does established history tell us about that? Nothing.
Exactly. Well, there's so many, you know, points that they leave out, and part of this process now is to kind of piece the puzzle together. And what I find interesting here also, you know, in regards to why I mentioned Atlantis and a little bit of that, is because you, in the book, you bring up and talk about, among other people, of course, but during the kind of the Victorian era, during colonialism, when kind of there was a kind of reemergence of these stories again, we have you know, excavations going on, archaeological digs around the world, with mainly people from England, France, and to some extent Germany, excavating Egypt and Sumer and stuff like that. And then a consequence of that is that a lot of people began writing about it. People like, for instance, Edward Bulwer Lytton, for example. Talking about
who is the father of comic book superheroes.
Would you say that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about this guy. This is interesting, and his you know, one of his famous books is, of course, the Coming Race. Tell us about it.
I'm really fascinated by this character. Edward Bulwer Lytton was Viceroy of India. He was a British lord, and he was also an ally of Benjamin Disraeli. He was a member of the House of Lords, and he was a reformist politician, but he was also very much involved in the occult and mysticism, and he wrote very popular, he was a member of the Rosicrucian Order. I don't believe he was involved in the Golden Dawn because he sort of predated them.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote some very famous literature. He was almost like the Stephen King of his time.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book on the he wrote The Last Days of Pompeii, which had a lot of occult and magical elements within it. He wrote a book called Zanoni, which dealt with the Rosicrucians. And he wrote The Coming Race. And The Coming Race sort of touches upon Hollow Earth theory, which is very popular during the time.
Yeah.
And basically the story is that this American geologist is exploring a cave and gets lost and finds this inner earth, this inner civilization of this race of super beings who, their society is powered by this substance called Vril. And it's almost a precursor to atomic energy. And these beings have advanced technology, which is really kind of remarkable in light of when the book was written. And these theories, not necessarily theories, but these themes would become very compelling to people in the Victorian era, because people were very much faced with this quandary of will machine replace man, and the answer would have to be to create a better man. And this is something that we see in alchemical texts. I mean, if you actually look at alchemical texts, they look like comic books. Actually, there was an alchemical text called the Mutus Liber that is formatted like a comic book. And I think the impulse here is, let's say, the conscious evolution of mankind, of, you know, improving humanity. And the way this filtered down is that we next see Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society, which took a lot of themes from Vril.
Yeah.
And then it sort of splits off into different directions. But today we see these themes in comic books as I said, but also in the self-help and the human potential movements. So just the idea of improving our lot in life is very compelling, and I think that Bulwer Lytton is sort of the progenitor of this.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. And of course, many people have kind of put a sinister stamp on him because of what you just described, that he influenced potentially, you know, Blavatsky, and many people have even said that Nazism kind of was spawned out of the ideas of you know, kind of a mixture between the Theosophical Society. I necessarily don't go there. I see it as a philosophy or an idea, again, a theme that has been laid out. And then a consequence of that is that people pick it up, get the wrong message or wrong idea, or even for their own reasons are influenced by it and kind of cherry pick the things that they want out of it and create their own mythology, and which consequently, you know, led to what you described earlier with the rise in the 30s, of course, with tyranny with Hitler and all this, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
What's your take on the entire thing? I know that you elaborate a little bit on Lytton in the book, that potentially his ideas actually are dangerous to begin with, and they shouldn't have been brought forward, or do you think that, you know, he did a good thing? What's your take on it?
You know, it's like technology. You know, first of all, so much of, you know, exposure that people have to things like Lytton or the occult or secret societies comes from a certain angle, comes from a certain take. And it comes from a lot of right-wing Christian fundamentalists who are going to see anything that they see as a competition to their worldview and their systems and their financial well-being as a threat. I can sort of step outside this and see the whole of it. I mean, I don't see this as as a partisan. But I think when you look at things like Vril, it's almost like technology. Technology is neutral. It's what human beings choose to do with technology. Mm-hmm. You talk about improving mankind, developing mankind's innate abilities. That is a technology. And in many ways, the Hermetic sciences, occultism, things like that are technologies. I don't think that they're inherently evil or wrong. I think what people choose to do with them is wrong. I mean, I don't necessarily trust secret societies. I think that secret societies had their place, you know, during the Inquisitions and things like that. But today, when you hear about a secret society, your radar instantly goes up and you feel suspicious. Because, you know, we have a free and open exchange of ideas today. Why do you need to act in secret? And then the occult. The occult just means secret. The occult to me is a misnomer, because everything that people were studying, the alchemists were studying in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, is available in every bookstore in America today. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not really a cult anymore. Really what it is that it's a different technology. So what people choose to do with it is the question. And you got to study the individuals. I mean, Christianity, can either be incredibly benign or incredibly evil. It all depends on the individuals. There is so much conspiracy theory literature out there that is so extreme and so hysterical, and will paint everything that they see as being divergent from their very totalitarian worldviews as being evil. To me, that's, you know, incredibly dangerous, because all systems of thought are essentially technologies, and what people choose to do with them is the question. If you have evil intent, like the Nazis did, you are going to manifest evil. If you have benign intent, you will do the opposite. Do you see what I'm saying?
Definitely.
Look at somebody like Carl Jung, who wanted to heal people and wanted to help people, and would draw upon a lot of the same things from Nietzsche and some of the occult revival of the late 19th century, because he saw these as being mythologies and systems of thought that are applicable in therapeutic psychology. So he wanted to do good with them. Hitler and Himmler and Alfred Rosenberg and all these people wanted to dominate and control every aspect of nature, every aspect of human lives, so they drew upon these technologies to do evil. It all depends on what your intent is. I really don't believe that there is inherent evil in a novel. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
It depends. You know, even a book, say a book like The Turner Diaries, which is about an extreme right-wing takeover of the United States, you can look at that book and use it as a window into a mind frame, into a mindset, or you can use that book, as Timothy McVeigh did, to, you know, to cause destruction in the world. I think that it's all about human intent. So I don't think that, you know, people who do comic book characters or science fiction movies have evil. They want to entertain people and they want to uplift people. They're not trying to brainwash people. There is a certain amount of predictive programming, but to these people, it's benign. They want to, you know, uplift humanity. Some people will see this differently and see it as mind control or whatever. It all depends on how you see it.
I see what you mean, and I guess I want to take it in two different ways from what you just have said there. And one is, the first one, I guess, is the most obvious. Since we're talking about bringing up the ancient gods again, or retelling of the story, I certainly can understand that someone from a Christian perspective is kind of threatened by this. I mean, they go after the Harry Potter stories. I mean, they go after a whole you know, all the stories basically that isn't, you know, biblical in nature, and talk about Christ as the only superhero. But I mean, I certainly would understand from their perspective then why they would kind of be threatened by it and so forth. Have you gotten any kind of that response to the book that, you know?
Well, the book came out last week, so it's still a little early.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought it was been...
I'm prepared to deal with it.
Okay, I
see. I have my arguments at hand.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, you know, Harry Potter is very popular. My problem with Harry Potter, and there's a very, you know, influential comic book creator named Neil Gaiman, who created The Sandman, and he's also involved with its production of Beowulf that's coming out now.
Mm-hmm.
He sees Harry Potter as having a dark side, not because of witchcraft or occultism, but because of the boarding school system that he grew up in, that he has experience in, and he knows it's very, you know, can be very oppressive and, you know, has totalitarian undercurrents to it.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's always been something that's bothered me about Harry Potter, and I think it's that glorification of this militaristic boarding school milieu.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Sure, I see what you mean.
but getting back to, I don't want to get involved too deeply in arguments with Christians on, you know, the historical aspects of the Bible, but there are characters in the Old Testament that very much have counterparts in mythology, and, you know, Samson.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And also Elijah. I mean, I really researched Elijah's history, and it's really fascinating to me. There's so many parallels with Hercules and with Helios. You know, just the fact that, to me, it's the story of Elijah is like a story of the battle of the sun gods, if you read those stories in the Old Testament. So, you know, I want to kind of avoid that because religion is so completely politicized today. It's kind of sad to me. You can't talk about religion without dealing with politics. And the reason I feel more comfortable in mythology and things like that is that we can take it outside of that, and we can look at it more objectively.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Another kind of strand that runs throughout, you know, the comic book, the industry is, if we talk about, let's take X-Men, for example, and we can even actually tie in the recent TV series hit Heroes, and what I see as a potential here, and what you mentioned earlier was the fact of what is known as predictive programming, that there could be an element in here, and this is just, you know, speculation, and see what you know what you feel about that argument and so forth, but could it be that
I think it's a very valid argument. I think there is a real potential there.
Yeah, but
and there may even be an actuality. I think that the X-Men was created in the early 60s and really had nothing to do with human engineering or genetics, any sort of outside agenda. It was a science fiction story. It was a fantasy story of a new race of human beings. And it was really probably unconsciously drawing back to the coming race. It had filtered down through many different permutations and ended up as the X-Men. The X-Men is very much a metaphor for people who feel marginalized and who feel marginalized because, you know, they're intelligent and you go to public schools where if you seem to be too bookish, you're become a target. And I think that's, you know, sort of the basic metaphor behind the original incarnation of the X-Men. But the X-Men also became popular in the 70s with gay kids, because gay kids sort of saw this as a metaphor for their feelings of marginalization. I mean, I don't think that was the intent of the writers in creating the stories, but I think that, that people latch on to these metaphors for their own personal reasons. Today what we see is that we see post-humanism, we see transhumanism, these technologies, and again, these technologies are not necessarily evil unto themselves. You can use these technologies to help people, or you can use these technologies to control people. And that, I think, is the real danger here, and the real reason that we need to be aware. You know, these stories are very much could lead us into some very troubling directions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if we do start to engineer a new race of human beings, you know, that didn't work out too well for the Neanderthals. The Cro-Magnon showed up, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So there's a lot of danger inherent here, but I think we as individuals don't have a tremendous amount of power to control that. I mean, Heroes is a very interesting show because it's what I call plain clothes superheroes. It takes superheroes out of the costumes and makes them more palatable to the general public. And there's a lot of shows like that. I mean, there's Smallville, which has been running for several seasons now, and when he was a high school kid and he doesn't wear the costume or anything like that. So, I mean, these themes are very popular where you take the comics out of the spandex and those fantasy, those power fantasies become very popular with a general audience.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you're right, there is a very much a danger there that this could be used to control people and control people's physical development.
Sure, sure.
And I'm you know, believe me, I am not a skeptic about predictive programming at all. I don't think that if you look at history seriously, that you can poo-poo it, because a lot of the people who are involved in it will outright tell you that that's what they're involved with, is using science fiction and literature and fantasy to influence human events. Again, that can either be really bad or be really good. One of the things, you know, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, but at the same time, I also understand that Star Trek is also a metaphor for the militarization of society. And you know, in the context of entertainment, it's fine. But the troubling possibility is when that leaves the screen, or leaves the TV screen, or leaves the comic book page, and people use that as an excuse to start programming the human condition.
Sure, exactly. And then that gets us back to that idea of where the lines might blur a little bit about when TV becomes, you know, so real for people that they can't distinguish, you know, they have I mean, this is so tiny, but again, I just want to mention it for the sake of what we're talking about here. When you go and see a movie and you see a real-life news presenter, for instance, that appear in the movie as themselves to talk about a news story about something that has happened in the film, that is those kind of small things that kind of helps to blur a little bit, I guess, for people, the idea, you know, that...
It becomes a continuum, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, where the heck is this? Where was it going? Was this, you know, when did this happen? When, you know, it's like, it blurs a little bit. But anyway, talking about this kind of getting people acclimatized to this... to these ideas, and what I find interesting here, and that's why I asked to begin with, is just because of what you just brought up, that... There is a potential of some kind of prophetic vision within, you know, those who write comic books, that they knew from, you know, in some way from not from day one, but this has obviously developed the genre and so forth. But they knew that there is some either some kind of natural evolution that is going to take place within, you know, the human race, or there is a technologically, you know, advancement that is going to occur, and this will involve genetics, and this will involve, you know, many other things. For instance, I was watching a Discovery Channel documentary just the other day, where they even laid out
exactly where you're going. Yeah.
What?
I know where you're going with this. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I saw this, and they laid it out with in exactly the same way, kind of a comic book was laid out. It was called the Real Superhumans or Real Superheroes or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You knew it. You saw that.
I haven't seen it yet, but I've definitely studied it.
Yeah.
Read up on it. Yeah.
Exactly. And what was interesting here, among other things, they brought up a guy that was blind. He was born without eyes, but he could draw. They had one guy who could run in the freezing cold up in Lapland, you know, a few miles above, you know, or just below the Arctic Circle, and he didn't, you know, get, you know, frostbites or anything like that. And they had one other girl who could see colors when she heard music, and there was what was interesting was that these people were now involved in giving away their DNA basically to different laboratories around the world to be tested.
Wow. Yeah.
In order to be in some ways utilized or potentially, you know, harvested basically. So I mean, again, just to express this idea that there is a fascinating kind of convergence going on here, but potentially then, is it natural evolution, or is this, you know, an outside external manipulation? And the fact that the comic books have a central role in this is very interesting. What do you think about that?
Well, there's an old song that goes, "You cannot go against nature, because when you do, that's part of nature too." I think what's going on now, it's, you know, as they used to say in the 60s, bigger than the both of us. We can't stop what's happening. We can't control it. It is inevitable. I mean, technological progress seems to have a mind of its own. The only thing that seems to stop it in history is, you know, these immense natural disasters. You know, we can go back to Atlantis, we can go back to Pompeii, things like that, all the earthquakes in Alexandria and such. It seems to just be the march of time and the march of technology are just inevitable. So what you really need to do is prepare yourself how you're going to react to that, how you're going to respond to that. There's no doubt in my mind, because we read about it, that there is, for instance, super soldier programs that are very much a reality. They're not science fiction. They're real. They're happening.
Yeah.
Where they are controlling people's genetics and building cybernetic technologies to create more efficient warriors, you know. These things will go on whether we like them or not. We've got to, as human beings, control our own personal evolution as best we can. And I think that knowledge and learning and awareness is very much a part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll hear a lot of people, you know, say, particularly conspiracy theorists, who will draw these really dire pictures of all these things going wrong in the world. And, you know, in many ways they're right. In many ways they're, you know, sensationalizing the problem. But then when they sort of come, you know, across with their answer to them, it's always a sort of nebulous, fuzzy, feel-goody kind of thing. And I don't know if that's very helpful. What you need to do is, first of all, study history and study the way things have happened. And you need to study what's going on today, and you need to control your personal evolution. You need to take care of yourself. You need to control your health. You need to control your emotions. You need to work as best you can. You need to form very solid relationships with people in your life, family and friends, things that will help you deal with crisis. Because, I mean, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that, you know, we're really sort of steamrolling towards a real crisis point in human history.
It seems like.
And what I would like people to do, personally, is that if they do study these read my book. First of all, I'd like them to read my book, for sure.
Of course.
Second of all, if they do decide to take that to the next level, I mean, there are examples in comic books and, you know, morals and teachings like that that can help you, that you can apply to your life.
Mm.
You know, let me just say this. This is kind of amusing because I would go to temple on Friday night, or go to mass on Saturday night, and then all day Sundays were church, you know, and church related events.
Mm-hmm.
But really, where I learned my sense of right and wrong was from comic book superhero stories. You know, there's a very clear mythology and morality there, and in a lot of ways, it's more clear and less ambiguous than religious teachings can be, because religious teachings are a lot about the group psychology.
Mm.
And that people outside of our group are inherently evil, no matter what they do or believe.
Yeah.
So I think that what we're talking about, what we're seeing, you know, personally, you have to deal with as best you can.
Yes.
And the first step to that is being aware.
Exactly. And you know, we need to round things up here for our first segment. Before we do that, I do want to mention, you know, that I think your book is excellent in that way, because it kind of tracks and gives people an idea of the background of the comic book, the history behind it, where some of the characters come from, and how this again has been brought forward. And I think it's a good kind of very good research tool in order to, you know, see where why there is such a, you know, so much revamping going on. The film industry is, you know, invaded by many comic book characters now, and the you know, there's so much more of these stories coming out all the time, and we're getting closer to this point. And that's why I really like your book, because it lays out many of the background characters of those people that were involved, but also many of the characters are actually working with it now. And I want to talk about that more in our next segment, people like Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, and Alan Moore, and others, of course. But again, I think the book is excellent, Christopher. I mean, job well done, as they say. The book is called Our Gods Wear Spandex, and I want to give, you know, everyone who want to get a copy of your book, how would they most easily go about doing that?
The easiest way to do it is through Amazon.com. There's a blog up on the Our Gods Wear Spandex page. There's a lot of excerpts, a lot of illustrations, there's a lot of stuff to read.
Mm.
And look at, you know, a lot of information. There's going to be some original material put up on that page,
mm-hmm.
A new essay. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Amazon.com. I think they're a great thing. I buy from them all the time,
mm-hmm.
and they're worldwide. So I think that would probably be the best place for your listeners to check out.
Nice.
And if
yeah.
not, their local bookstore or comic book store.
Nice. And people can also find links, I guess, from that to Amazon from your blog, secretsun.blogspot.com, isn't it right?
I don't think I have an active link yet.
You got to put a link.
There is a lot of, you know, secondary information that they can read on the blog.
Yeah.
Plus, the blog, I really go further along into symbolism and mythology and modern mythology, because, you know, there's an idea that mythology ended in the ancient world, but mythology is something that's constantly happening. It's constantly reinventing itself.
That's right.
It's constantly playing out in the world today.
We'll take a short break here, Chris, but we'll continue talking in the next segment. But thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, believe me.
Subscribers, head on over to our member section and tune in to the continuation of this interview with Christopher Knowles.
Where do we come from?
We're going to talk much more about one of Chris's upcoming projects on movie symbolism. We'll also talk about the Templars and John the Baptist, and many of the references this biblical character has in today's movies, and much, much more. So head on over to our website, redicecreations.com, to find out how to sign up and tune in. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls, and thank you for listening. Red Ice Creations Radio will be back on Thursday. Until then, take good care. Subscribers, we'll see you on the other end of this break.